Translation. My dear son, whatever you inquired from me, I have thus explained unto you. And you must know for certain that whatever there is, either as cause or as effect, both in the material and spiritual worlds, is dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Purport. The complete cosmic situation, both in the material and in the spiritual manifestations of the energies of the Lord, is working and moving first as the cause and then as the effect. But the original cause is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Effects of the original cause become the causes of other effects. And thus everything, either permanent or temporary, is working as cause and effect. And because the Lord is the primeval cause of all persons and all energies, he is called the cause of all causes, as confirmed in the Brahma Samhita, as well as in the Bhagavad Gita. The Brahma Samhita affirms, Ishvara Parama Krishna Sachit Ananda Vigraha Anadya Adya Govinda Sarva Karana Karanam. And in the Bhagavad Gita it is said, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo Mata Sarvam Pravartate Iti Matta Bhajante Mam Buddha Bhava Samanvitaha. So the original primeval cause is Vigraha, the personal, and the impersonal spiritual effulgence, Brahma Jyoti, is also an effect of the Supreme Brahman, Brahmano Hipatishtaham, Lord Krishna. Translation again. My dear son, whatever you inquired from me, I have thus explained unto you, and you must know for certain that whatever there is, either as cause or as effect, both in the material and spiritual worlds, is dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Om Agena Chimadandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militang Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. Narada Muni has inquired from Lord Brahma about what's going on with the cosmic manifestation. He wants to know, what's the background? And is there any superior entity beyond Lord Brahma? So Lord Brahma is answering, and he's giving confidence to his listener, to Narada Muni, that whatever you have inquired from me, I have explained it all to you. And therefore, you should know certain facts that are immovable. You can't get around it. That there is that ultimate cause, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada begins saying the complete cosmic situation. For someone who lacks knowledge coming from Lord Brahma, the complete cosmic situation is a mystery. And we can see that even with the very incomplete partial knowledge that human beings today think they have, they haven't learned how to live properly on this small patch of the universe. This chapter, Purusha Shukta confirmed, is relating everything that you see in material existence to the ultimate source. Lord Brahma is painting an authorized picture for Narada Muni so that the less intelligent person can understand how all aspects of existence, both material and spiritual, emanate from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We're talking here about a different kind of vision, which leads to a different kind of civilization. First of all, relating everything that you see, everything that you experience to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is a great step forward. But then there must be some gratitude. Otherwise, you risk becoming an impersonalist who would say that, yes, everything is the divine, everything is spiritual, but they don't express any gratitude, what to speak of devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We give them credit for understanding, either through metaphysics or through ecological studies, that everything is connected, everything is part, and interrelated as part, but they don't know what is the complete whole, beyond even a partial understanding of the cosmic manifestation. Even with that very incomplete understanding, still, there's not even the slightest gratitude. What to speak of devotional service? So this is the problem with ecological consciousness. Certainly, it has a temporary and immediate effect, which is necessary. But you see that human beings can't even get it together on the temporary immediate platform. Whether they have meetings in Rio de Janeiro or Glasgow or Paris or Copenhagen or wherever the next meeting is. Because they can't control their mind and senses. There's not even agreement, what to speak of, a united effort to actualize the agreement. At some point, human beings need to understand that because they are bereft of a connection with the ultimate source, Swayam Bhagavan, all their efforts are useless. But that, it seems, to understand that takes such a big leap of faith. It seems to be asking too much in this day and age. You can just imagine someone saying to you when you present that we need to revive our dormant connection. They say, well, are you talking about the blue boy? Is that the solution to all the problems? Because they're not ready to hear that in depth. Therefore, Lord Brahma is explaining to Narada that at least you can appreciate the universal form as the body of the Supreme and show some gratitude, you idiots. But even showing gratitude is considered antiquated. I remember in Sunday school they taught us a song which definitely expresses some gratitude. Who made the mountains? Who made the seas? Somebody bigger than you or me. That's nice sentiment. But even that kind of sentiment is considered to be not very intellectual. I remember as a 14-year-old being sent to boarding school in the mountains of New Hampshire in the USA. Elitist boarding schools trying to imitate the British. And so I remember riding my bicycle in the mountains in the autumn. The leaves were turning. And I was thinking, this is so beautiful. Obviously there's God. But then just 2 years later, because it was a school related to the Episcopal Church, the American version of the Anglican Church, sooner or later, a priest showed up to lecture the students. And he was explaining in his lecture, as we sat in chapel, we had to go to chapel for 15 minutes twice a week. We hated it. He said, look at the mountains, look at the seas, look at the sky. Surely there's God. And I remember turning to my friends and saying, oh, how unscientific. So now you have a society that is shorn of any connection to the source of all the energy, but uses so much energy. It's all about energy, this kind of energy, that kind of energy, how to exploit it, how to get more. And to get more, you have to deprive others of it. And so therefore there's envy and conflict in the world because no one can get enough material resources. And everyone is uptight that our supply of resources will be cut off, whether it's gas or oil or titanium or cobalt or lithium or whatever. There are always limited supplies, so who's going to be the top dog? Who's going to wind up with the lion's share of all the resources? What is the engine of disaster behind all this unnecessary conflict, unnecessary turmoil? It is the notion that without constant economic growth, human society is not a human society. The standard of living must constantly go up. And that takes more and more resources. And without economic growth, the people will become violent. So it's a social necessity, besides an economic necessity. It's a social necessity to have constant economic growth. What happens if that disappears? The people will become restless. The people will become agitated. And then the death rate will increase. Of course, the death rate's 100%, but this is the fear that people have. Without constant economic growth, we'll be deprived of all the basic necessities. I remember Srila Prabhupada saying a very insightful statement that struck me very deeply. He said, economic development is lust on an organized scale. The personal lust becomes organized on a societal level. And therefore, it's the same old thing, but just on a wider scale. Even before understanding that constant emphasis on economic growth destroys spiritual incentive, even before that, at least we can understand that the so-called economic growth is uneconomical. You don't calculate all the negative effects of your growth, the growth madness. You don't calculate the air pollution, the pandemics, the effect on people's health, the environmental destruction. That's not on the balance sheet. So actually, even from the material point of view, you're not successful. What to speak of the spiritual point of view? Therefore, as I often explain, these days to call someone a materialist is a great compliment. By your calling them a materialist, you're implying that they have some expertise in living material life. But just look at this madness of economic growth. When you add up all the economic negatives, the bad consequences, the so-called economic growth becomes completely uneconomical. And we're not even talking about the spiritual side. There's this deep fear. The last thing we want is economic stagnation. Oh my God. How can we be human beings? So some persons say, okay, let's de-emphasize economic growth and increase the quality of life. Because people may wonder, if you stop growing economically, then what do you do? So others say, emphasize the quality of living, health care, and leisure time. And still, they've missed the point. That the real quality of life is spiritual development. And therefore, Brahma is speaking to Narada Muni a picture, an authorized picture, of how everything is related to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and we should live our life in that way. Maybe you remember the first time you read this chapter. I received it in 1972. At that time, the BBT hadn't published the second canto or the first canto, but there were some chapters published as publications on their own. So I remember. I wasn't chanting Hare Krishna. I wasn't following a bhakti lifestyle, but I was reading the books, and Purusha Sukta confirm. Oh, this is really... this is really exotic. Reading the verses about how all these different items come from the limbs of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But there was a special, cohesive, holistic charm to it that attracted me. Of course, it's Srimad Bhagavatam, literary incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But even though I wasn't conscious of being attracted to Krishna, and although the verses in this chapter are so, it seems so exotic, especially to a newcomer, to an less than a neophyte, there was something that beckoned, something that called you to go deeper. Our efforts to convince people that everything is related to Krishna do have that charm, that transcendental charm. And yes, we use logic, we use reason, but also let us not forget that the speaking about Krishna, relating everything to Krishna, has an undeniable charm that can't be calculated from the material point of view. So therefore, when we talk about quality of life, we're really talking about the Krishna conscious quality of life. Certainly, if your governments would pay more attention to the quality of material living, that would help. But they like to spend lots of money on nuclear weapons. Just like your country here in the UK has announced that they're going to significantly up their investment in nuclear weaponry. It's been calculated that of the 9 nuclear states in the world, last year they spent on nuclear weapons, just last year, $82 billion. So you can, it's been, mathematicians have broken that down so you can understand how much that is per minute. So that's $150,000 per minute being spent on nuclear weapons. But meanwhile, the politicians like to talk about the quality of life. So we have a major problem here because the energy is not related to the energetic source. That basic understanding is not there. That basic understanding that's given in Sri Isha Upanishad, everything is owned and controlled by the Supreme. First, there has to be that kind of fundamental wisdom on your way to understanding Krishna. But we might say, well, therefore we shouldn't talk about Krishna. We should just talk about the fundamental understandings. But Prabhupada did both at the same time. And that's our challenge. And it's a great art. It's a great science. How to deal with the fundamentals while at the same time retaining the Krishna charm. Because ultimately everything is personal. But we can be a little shy that, well, the people aren't ready to even hear the name of the blue boy. to hear about the blue boy. And so therefore we can just speak about the fundamentals without mentioning Krishna. That has some value, but ultimately you'll become dissatisfied, just like Vyasadeva was dissatisfied. And Narada Muni had to point out to him that you've spoken so much, especially in Mahabharata, economics, politics, this, that, the other, intrigue and war, drama, but you haven't glorified Krishna enough. So our constant effort is how to reach people with the fundamentals while at the same time not forgetting the Krishna charm, because Krishna is unlimitedly attractive. Otherwise, we'll be trapped just in terms of, okay, we agree. Someone can say to you, we agree that the focus should be on the quality of life, not this economic growth monster. Mm-hmm. But then we have to discuss what is that quality of life. And sooner or later, the discussion about the quality of life has to lead to Krishna. As this purport here ends, after Prabhupada is spending sentences speaking about causes and effects, very philosophical, effects of the original cause become the causes of other effects, and thus everything, either permanent or temporary, is working as cause and effect. So at the end, he caps it all off. So, the original primeval cause is Vigraha, the personal. And the impersonal spiritual effulgence, Brahmajyoti, is also an effect of the Supreme Brahman, Lord Krishna. So, sooner or later, we have to get there. Now, sometimes devotees argue, and they often bring this point up to me. Well, Maharaj, what about indirect preaching as compared to direct preaching? They've been asking me several times this question in London. You all have been working, not you all, but in central London, they worked me pretty hard. Practically have no voice anymore. But that question came up several times. Shouldn't we focus on the indirect? Or when do we ever mention the direct? So I gave them my opinion, which is why waste time in this unnecessary dichotomy? Why not do both at the same time? So I suggested to them at their outreach center, some days are what you might call indirect, and some days are direct, and in that way you can try to reach everyone. My own personal strategy is that if you just want to hear about the indirect, you pay more money. And if you come on the direct nights, you pay less money. So if you want to avoid hearing about Krishna directly, all right, but you'll pay for the privilege. And by paying for the privilege, you'll support the outreach on the direct nights. By your paying for the privilege of not hearing about Krishna directly, you'll provide resources for supporting the direct efforts. So anyway, that's one possible solution I thought I would mention. But I was surprised how often devotees would ask me that question. And I could see it's very important. And it relates to Srimad Bhagavatam first canto, in which Vyasadeva's feeling despondent. And this is very interesting because, especially in this particular Divya Yuga, the set of four yugas, Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dwarpa Yuga, and Kali Yuga, Vyasadeva, who appeared in Dwarpa Yuga, he's not a Shaktivesh avatar. He's a plenary expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is explained by Jiva Goswami in Tattva Sandarbha, that actually the name Vyasadeva refers to different personalities, each of whom appear in every set of four yugas. So it's very interesting that the plenary expansion Vyasadeva in our particular Divya Yuga, he's feeling despondent, and Narada Muni is telling him. And Narada Muni is a Shaktivesh avatar. He's empowered to teach bhakti. So he's telling him, you haven't glorified Krishna enough. Now in the third canto, Vidura, in speaking with Maitreya, gives Vyasadeva some credit for, I know your purpose. You spoke all that politics and economics and whatever is there in Mahabharata because you wanted to attract people to that chapter, that section of known as Bhagavad Gita. It's very interesting. But Narada Muni, his version is, you didn't speak enough about Krishna. All right, you did this, you did that. Well done, but. And therefore you're despondent. So we can conclude that whether it was effective or not to write about so many things, but not give enough about Krishna, whether that's effective or not, maybe is not the essential point. The essential point is, at least the point we can focus on for now, one aspect is that Vyasadeva was despondent. He wasn't feeling enlivened. So I think this is why the question often comes up amongst devotees who want to show compassion. They want to outreach, and they're wondering, how much can the people handle? Sometimes that concern is just a demonstration of our lack of conviction that anarto pashamam sakshat bhakti yogam adokshade. The miseries of the living entities are superfluous. They can all be solved by the linking process of bhakti yoga. So it's a juggling act. How to give people the fundamentals so that they can immediately relate to that while not forgetting that there's that inconceivable charm about mentioning Krishna this way or that way. So we're living in very tumultuous times, and we're seeing that the world is becoming more and more fragmented, and the problems are becoming increasingly obvious. We're starting to see major parts, even of the ISKCON world, being sealed off due to geopolitics. Devotees in China, there's so many devotees in China, but they're right now under severe restriction. Devotees in Russia, they can have international connections. So we have to start thinking about how human beings are actually focused on destroying themselves, and that's starting to affect our outreach. It's starting to affect our society that's trying to be transcendental. People are starting to wonder, is there anything different? Is there anything better? Or are we just stuck with the same old understandings? I was explaining at various events in Europe, in Hungary and Wales and also London, a very respectable survey, very authorized survey that was done in 10 nations of the world, including the USA, Canada, and the UK, about generation, you say Z or Z here? Generation Z. That means between the ages of 18 and 30, approximately. Anyone here in that age group? Okay. Of course, you are here in Bhaktivedanta Manor in the rarefied atmosphere created by the Bhakti Yoga practice. But you should know that your generation was asked the question, how do you feel about the current state of human affairs? 50% of them in these countries like UK, USA, Canada, 50% said humanity is doomed. 50%. It sounds so exotic, doesn't it, to us old folks? I mean, 50% of young people think humanity is doomed? What kind of world is this? And indeed, we have to wonder, what kind of world is this? How it's going to turn out, who can say? You'd be surprised how many persons think that we need nuclear weapons, that they safeguard our freedoms. That we must have economic growth at all costs, otherwise people won't be satisfied. But how can material acquisitions satisfy anyone? In fact, they'll always be, because of such an emphasis on the madness of economic growth, there'll always be the haves and the have-nots. It seems almost mystical when we think about, for example, the verse Prabhupada would always quote, Sarva Kama Dugamahi. What's the first line? Imam Vavarsha Parjanya? What's the first word? Anyone know? No one knows that verse. Sarva Kama Dugamahi. During the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira, the cloud. Kamam Vavarsha Parjanya. Sarva Kama Dugamahi. Thank you. Used to be such a famous verse back in the early days. Now, no one knows. During the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira, because Maharaj Yudhisthira was such an extraordinary spiritual executive, there were no shortages of material necessities, and in fact, the material resources were overflowing. So let's examine that situation on two levels. Kamam Vavarsha Parjanya Sarva Kama Dugamahi. And some people with a little bit of brains are understanding these days that you can't have unlimited economic growth on a planet with limited resources. Something's got to give. It's not rocket science. So their solution is to stop this conception that is so... You'd be shocked to know how this conception is so prevalent. We must have economic growth. Oh, my God. How's the economy doing? Is the economy expanding? Oh, no. Stagnation. Oh, no. Some persons do understand it can't go on like this because you're living with limitations. The Earth's resources are limited. Therefore, you have to get human beings to expand in a different way, not economically, but maybe we should, as I said before, we should make better health care, better facilities for leisure time, and take, in that way, literally take the heat off the Earth planet. But actually, Bhagavatam is presenting something else. It's saying that the Earth can supply population far beyond what's present now if people would change their attitude. And therefore, the historical example of Yudhisthira Maharaj, Prichit Maharaj is given, that during their time, the Earth was not only supplying necessities for everyone, but the Earth was overflowing due to the attitude, the consciousness of the people, which was shaped by the attitude of Prichit Maharaj and Yudhisthira. So it's a different... We start off the same as everyone else. Yes, you can't have unlimited material desires on a planet with limited resources. Something's got to give. You're on a burnout path. But then we diverge because we know that, for example, in that verse, Kamam Bhavarsha Parjanya Sarva Kama Dugami, it refers to the cows because the cows had a cheerful attitude. Their milk overflowed the earth. So that sounds kind of quaint, even to environmentalists. The cows have a cheery attitude, eh? And that leads to more resources? I don't recommend you write your PhD dissertation based on that because they won't like it. But maybe you could. Maybe you could actually could make it through logic and reason, present that conclusion that the attitude of the cows, the attitude of the people, determines material nature increasing the supply of resources or restricting the supply of resources. So that is a very radical concept, but actually the Bhagavatam makes it work and gives you the system of lifestyle for understanding how this is actually what works. That nature has the capacity to provide unlimited resources for an unlimited population. In other words, we're not the controllers. And therefore, Lord Brahma is going through this whole dialogue with Narada Muni by which someone can understand. We're just part of a network that's controlled by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And because not everyone's ready to hear completely about the transcendental body of Lord Krishna, Brahma's saying, okay, visualize the universe as the form of the Lord. This is stated by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. First, Krishna describes the Mahatmas. Mahatmanas tumam partha daivim prakritim ashritaha. Then, satatam kirtayantamam. This is what the Mahatmas do. They're always glorifying me. But, gana yagyena chapyanye, there are others. Yajanto mam upasate, ekak tvena patak tvena. There's some who just are monists. They do understand that there's a spiritual energy. They do understand they're not the body. But they don't accept that they are subordinate to a supreme. They don't accept, as Prabhupada ended the purport here. So the original primeval cause is vigraha, the personal. Don't accept that. But they get credit for understanding you're not the body. Then class number two, the pantheists. Whatever form you choose, that is God. Demigods, this, that, rocks, mountains, whatever. And then number three, Vishvatomukam, the universal form, accepting the universe as the body of the Supreme. So in some way, just understanding that the energies of nature are related to an ultimate source, that's a great step forward. But right now, humanity needs more than that. There's not much time, not much scope, and not much capacity for people just to hear the fundamentals shorn of any connection to Krishna. So we need a sense of urgency that we can't get around speaking about Krishna and Srimad Bhagavatam, although we all have our different approaches how to get to that point, but we must get to that point. That is my point. All right, any questions? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Thank you so much for the nice class. I just had a question which is quite practical. So a lot of times when we're out on the streets or we talk to people, we can see that they're struggling with so many things. They struggle with their relationships, they struggle with work, they're burning out, they have financial problems. And then here we come and say, okay, chant these holy names for 2 hours and all your problems are going to be solved. So I wanted to ask, how can we show them that by taking all this process, all their other needs are also being taken care of?
Yes, what you're saying requires to deal with that phenomenon, as you described, take some non-mentalness of the Sankirtan devotee or the outreach devotee, because otherwise it can throw you. Like, hey, I mean, get real. I mean, the world's, you know, about to blow itself up, you know. We just had a heat wave, you know, record-breaking temperatures. And here you are saying, I should spend 2 hours a day chanting some mantra. I thought like that myself in the beginning. I loved to read the books, Prabhupada's books. I would read them at home 4 hours a day, 6 months straight before I ever went to a temple or a bhakti gathering. I thought the books are wonderful, but these Hare Krishnas, they seem a bit dreamy and impractical. What are they doing for the world? As if I was doing something for the world. Don't get mental when someone says like that. Oh, God, how am I going to answer that? I think it's true what they're saying. I mean, I didn't mean that. I mean, the root of the problem is contaminated consciousness. And unless you solve that problem, not only will the material problems not be solved, but they'll increase. So you can explain to them in that way. During my university days, at one of the imitation British elitist institutions, I was determined to find a solution to all material problems. My professors let me study whatever I wanted because I told them this is my goal. And they told me that's what the university is actually meant for. And then they concluded by saying, and if you find, during your 4 years of study, if you happen to find a solution to all the problems, come back and let us know. In other words, you're not going to find anything. So before reading Prabhupada's books, I was already convinced there's no material solution. So next, the next thing I had to deal with was the exoticness of Krishna. But I just loved hearing about Krishna and Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. But in the beginning, I couldn't relate that to solving the world's problems. I just thought, well, this is the best enjoyment. So if you're convinced, if you don't get mental about it, if you're convinced that, yes, this is the solution, the people pick up on that. And Krishna helps them in their heart. Krishna as a super soul in your heart sees this devotee is convinced. And then Krishna as a super soul in the heart of the person that you're talking to says, listen to what he's saying. Those are the inner dynamics of outreach, Sankirtan, book distribution, what have you. It's actually teamwork between you and the super soul. So you're not alone. You've got ample help. Yes.
Thank you so much, Mahesh, for your wonderful class. So yes, I'm going to have classes in Hungary and in Atlanta.
You're lucky.
Unfortunately not. So
my question is a little bit not really connected to the class, but I hope you're going to reply.
Thanks for warning me.
Forgive me. Okay. How you can... sorry, I'm a little dyslexic. So, how you can always have to have constant effort in your determination and to be able to continue with your Krishna's... for seva, for Krishna, in your limit of your... limit of your energy that is affected by disability.
Well, you must be asking me that question because you know I'm exhausted from... I've reached the limit of my physical capacity. We all have to pray to Krishna how we can engage in his service in spite of physical limitations, which will always be there, whether we are young or old, but which do increase as you get older. But even young persons can have some handicap or disability. There's always some barrier in this world, whether this or that. But we're striving to understand how bhakti is transcendental to all material limitations. That takes some effort. We have to push ourselves to get that understanding. Otherwise, yes, we can easily become discouraged. When I hear about devotees in various countries of the world undergoing restrictions or undergoing violence, and it makes you question, Krishna, don't you care? His Holiness Niranjan Maharaj has just prepared a book called Krishna Protects His Devotees. It's particularly about the military conflict in Ukraine. And there you have testimonies of devotees coping with extraordinary circumstances, or you might say ordinary circumstances in this world. War is always going on in this world. So how can they serve Krishna? And then I'm hearing about devotees in China who the government has suddenly increased its restrictions on them. They have to hide their japa beads, hide their books, hide their deities. police are showing up at their homes and with a list of all the list of names of all the devotees. Do you know this one? Do you know that one? Very intimidating. So there are all kinds of disabilities. So we need to hear examples of how, in spite of handicaps, disabilities, and barriers, bhakti still goes on.
Thank you.
Anything else? Yes? Well, we should offer yoga. Of course, you can offer yoga in such a way that you refer to Bhagavad Gita, but some say just offer the yoga class, get the people to come, or Ayurveda, or mindfulness, or These things are being presented, and so I was just pointing out that sometimes persons ask my opinion. I say, okay, whatever gets people in the door, but make sure you have facility for presenting Krishna. That was my point. However you do it, simultaneously, in one room you have the so-called indirect, in the other room you have the direct. Or one day you have the indirect, and the next day you have the direct. Just have to be a little creative about it. Rather than devotees getting into arguments about an unnecessary dichotomy. Ah, you're just doing the indirect. Ah, you're too heavy. You're doing the direct. Do it all for fun and profit. But make sure that Krishna is there. Otherwise, you'll become dry and despondent. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.